touchdown machine for the Houston Cougars.
Sasser again, just kind of taking over right now.
That's NBA stuff right there. He is a baller.
Stick it in your pipe and smoke it, baby.
Yes! Welcome to the Scott Holman Podcast, where we are back tonight talking all things Houston Cougars, and all things Houston Cougars tonight quite literally means 11 different sports, 12 if you want to split out the men's and women's AAC indoor championships the Cougars will be going to, or actually currently about to start in Birmingham. And it's just a jam-packed episode, Dustin. Not all of it's positive, but we're going to talk about a really, I think, pivotal three-game stretch for men's basketball. We're going to talk about, I would say, the program that's fast challenging H-Town Speed City, as much as H-Town Speed City's resume is kind of untouchable. Cougars swimming and diving, getting their seventh title in a row. That's really cool. And because we're going to talk about so much, Dustin, I'm going to cut my intro here. I'm going to ask you how you're doing, bud, even though I saw you several days ago, but still curious here, having seen you just this past weekend. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing all right. I am. I went a little bit pale when you mentioned how many sports we have to talk about here, because we're less than 9.5 hours from this moment. I need to be at work tomorrow morning, so I think we might be speed running through this a little bit. I know I am going to be speed running through this a little bit, but definitely have a lot to talk about, and didn't want to miss the opportunity to come back and get caught up on all the latest goings on in Cougardom.
No doubt. I will try to get through this as efficiently as possible, because I think a lot of sports deserve talking about. And if we talked about them all for the exact same amount of time, it would be 6 hours and you'd have to be up for work in about 30 minutes. So we're not going to do that. But we'll quickly mention here at the top, we are proud members of the 1012 Network. Follow them on Twitter at TEN12 Network. Subscribe to the 1012 podcast wherever you put podcasts in your ears. And of course, also give a donation if you are so inclined, if you have the ability to do so, to our podcast, to our weekly premium episodes. Patreon.com/SHPAWDcast. We've done 10 premium episodes that I'm quite proud of, and going to give you definitely more than 10 to come this season of stuff we maybe don't have time to talk about because of how awesome and jam-packed the current Cougar season is. But Patreon.com/SHPAWDcast, of course. Also support our friends, our good friends, the good brand, HomeFieldApparel.com. Great makers of incredibly comfortable, incredibly unique vintage collegiate apparel, a great Houston Cougar collection that I wore in person at the Fertitta Center this past Sunday. Felt good doing it, looked good doing it. And I'm not someone who feels like he looks good doing very much, but I felt like I really looked good in that sharp Home Field Apparel Sailor Cougar shirt. You, the listener, can just, by listening to this podcast, save 15% off your first order, and you're going to do that just by entering the promo code Holman12, H-O-L-M-A-N-1-2 at checkout. Save 15% on that first order, an incredible collection, hundreds of schools, supporters of this podcast, Home Field Apparel. You're going to help us, you're going to look good doing it, really. Just going to hit an absolute grand slam in terms of a consumer experience. Dustin, championships always lead here on this podcast. And even though it's become an extremely regular occurrence now, I would say maybe the most consistent regular occurrence now in our eighth season of doing this show, I think it never gets old. It never gets any less exciting or impressive to see the way Houston Cougars swimming and diving, now spanning multiple coaches, now spanning nearly a decade, is this dynasty that now is a 7 in a row AAC champion, capturing that title this past weekend in Dallas. No better way to cap off your final season in the American, is there not?
No, really, you can't do a lot better than that. You know, I hadn't even thought about it until you mentioned it like that, but yeah, you know, University of Houston had never won a swimming and diving conference title before Sam and I started this podcast. Now all of a sudden they do it basically every year. So clearly the correlation equals causation there, and I'm going to just leave it at that. But no, I mean, despite the fact that this was, 7 years in a row now that Houston has won the American Conference Championship, not a foregone conclusion by any stretch. This one was very close with four teams all performing at a high level, but the Cougs did come out on top yet again. They've done it with now two different coaches. They've done it in blowouts. They've, you know, won a couple of times now by incredibly thin margins, but this program just keeps on winning titles, and they'll leave the AAC on a streak of 7 consecutive conference championships. And, you know, notably a couple of schools that are joining the AAC next year in all sports, for whatever reason, came in a year early for swimming and diving. So Houston,
I would tell them, winning its seventh straight title. USA stopped sponsoring swimming. That's why FIU
Oh, is that? Okay.
Yeah.
They just let him in. All right. Anyway, so they edged out conference newcomers Florida International. The Cougs had 1,311.5 points, while FIU remarkably had an even 1,300. SMU finished a close third, and Rice, who just actually beat Houston head-to-head a little bit ago, finished in fourth place. So there was then a pretty big gulf before the rest of the conference there. But that top four, all very competitive, so not an easy match for the Cougs, certainly there. Meet, I should say, not match. Getting my words mixed up there. But the Cougs, you know, they get this win with a couple of key seniors, but also a lot of depth in the underclassmen who contributed for the Cougs. Definitely, you know, going to be some losses heading into the Big 12 next year with some of those seniors. But feels like a really strong base for Tanika Jameson to build off of. She was now named Conference Coach of the Year in both of her seasons at U of H, and you know, I think that's exciting because while the program in Austin is a juggernaut that is fairly certain to end Houston's conference title streak next year, once that program leaves the Big 12, the Big 12 is fairly wide open, and there is reason to believe that Houston can be a real competitor there, especially with some of the freshmen that that competed in this one will still be around, hopefully, in a couple of years when Houston is hopefully competing for championships in a wide open Big 12.
Yeah, I think you kind of mentioned it, the challenge of getting that seventh title. I think amplified a little bit by the fact that you had those Conference USA schools coming in a year early. You had a one-off program in FIU. Actually, the program that was closest to you, the Cougars, edged FIU by 11.5 points to get that title. My fancy math, Dustin, tells me that's an 11-point improvement margin over that half a point win about 12 months ago. But included a Rice team that not that long ago just won a dual meet against the Cougars. Two of the top women's team performances in this meet came from new schools. So I think the challenge to get that seventh title, which isn't to say some of the really good teams of years past wouldn't have still found a way to win it, but I think it became even more difficult than last year with still a very young roster, especially on the swimmer side. And to win it against a larger field of competition and do it by a slightly greater margin than last year, I think that really checks all the boxes. I want to shout out some of the individual performances. I thought really what was so impressive, Dustin, I mean, you had some podiums in there, but it was just U of H won this by volume of contributors, which I think says something. It says that you have a lot of athletes and a lot of, I guess, competence really across the board in a lot of events. But I got to shout out one of your athletes competing in their final event, Chase Ferris, getting a podium in all three diving events, first in the 3 meter, second in the platform, and also second in the 1 meter. A number of other points performances from your divers behind Ferris. And you're really young on the swimmer side. I mean, nearly every athlete I kind of have in these notes here is a freshman or a sophomore, but that you had that veteran leadership from the diver group and that you were able to get so many points early in the competition, I'm sure did nothing but help the Cougars be able to hang on there in the last couple days of the competition. I want to shout out Eden Humphrey, a freshman, was first in the 500 freestyle swim in NCAA B cut, was also third in the 1650 freestyle and got an NCAA B cut there. Picked up some points in the 200 free as well with a fifth place finish. And Alondra Ortiz, fourth in the 400 IM. Flo Peter, fifth. Henrietta Fangley, one of the real standouts from last year, first in the 200 breaststroke consolation final, and also swam an NCAA B cut in that event as well. Just the Cougars picked up points in just about every event. I did, when I kind of put my notes together for this, Dustin, you probably did something similar. I did a Control F in Houston through the, you know, I guess, the meet results, and you hit so many different events where the Cougars had a points performer. And I think you had some teams win more events, but I don't think you had, obviously, based on the overall team results, a team that did as much different things well as the Cougars did in Dallas. And that's why we're talking about a seventh straight conference championship, that title being won because of that across-the-board depth. And, you know, it's such a common theme. I think we talk about most of the times we talk about this program, or certainly in the past season or two, but you were so young on the swimming side. Basically, every top performer is a freshman or sophomore. Eden Humphrey, who I just got done talking about, probably your best swimming overall performer, has potentially three more years in this program. I want to talk a conversation I had, Dustin, about this. I was back in Houston this past week, as I referenced. I was getting some late night food and drink with a friend of the show, Ish, and he asked me, which always feels weird, Dustin, I get asked as an ostensible expert in Cougar athletics. He honestly asked me, though, whether, in my opinion, this staff was inheriting a really good situation from the fantastic work done by the previous coach, or whether this staff played a large part. And I think obviously the fact that this coach stepped into a situation where the previous staff had won five titles in a row, that's never not going to help. And that there are athletes in this program recruited by that staff, that there's the expectation of winning in this program created by that staff. But this program graduated, I would say, certainly its best ever crop of swimmers in the two seasons prior to Jameson taking over here. So even if Waka Murka had stayed here, this was going to be a young team. This was going to be a team kind of at the beginning of the development cycle, regardless of who was here. And that Jameson was able to guide this extremely young group to two team championships in the last two seasons, I think that should be an immense credit to her and the staff working with her. Deservedly, your American Women's Swimming Coach of the Year, and for like the umpteenth year in a row, Bob Gunter being named the Women's Diving Coach of the Year, Chase Ferris getting the Women's Outstanding Diver of the Year. Just really, really cool performance. That's really cool to see this team and its time in the American on such a high note.
Yeah, it's funny. I have a really similar bullet point in my notes about that. Yeah, Houston just didn't win a ton of events, and maybe that has to do with there being a lot more teams in the conference this year. But it also, like I said, felt like such a team effort because it was just so many athletes competing, so many athletes getting points. You know, the top 16 performers all scored points in a swimming and diving event in Houston. Really won by being the deepest program in the conference, and I think that's why you saw the difference between losing the head-to-head with Rice versus where you have to, you know, just win more events because you're just going one-on-one against another team versus having the depth to score, having multiple scores and just basically every event. And it just makes it a real, real team win. You did mention, Chase Ferris, obviously being named outstanding diver of the conference. Another senior I want to mention in her, final conference match or conference meet. Keep doing the match thing for some reason. I don't know why. Final conference meet, Julia Kolodic won the 200-yard backstroke. But yeah, hard not to get really excited about some of, especially the freshman you mentioned, Eden Humphrey, showing that she's just awesome at basically every distance of freestyle event, from winning the 500 to, podium finish in the 1650 to a top five finish in the 200 free. Very impressive. Alondra Ortiz as well, multiple events that she did, take third in the 200 butterfly, in addition to that fourth in the IM. Virag Peter, a pair of top five finishes. Landry Hatter, another freshman, a pair of top seven finishes. So some really, really strong performances. You mentioned a lot of freshmen and sophomores, and you just like the way that plans out, because like I said, it's next year you go into the Big 12, you go, okay, this is kind of your who finishes second.
You're probably not
going to
win the league with the Longhorns against you. That's just a fair expectation. Sorry.
Right, but your freshmen and sophomores next year are sophomores and juniors, and then a year after that, when you've kind of got the wide open the wide open field, they're at that point, they're sophomores and juniors and seniors. So I think this is going to be a group that is already showing a lot of promise, and I think that really bodes well for where they're going to be in a couple of years once Houston gets into the Big 12. And it's very, I think, reminiscent of Ryan Waka Murka taking over in the first place, where you saw this, some of these kind of narrow conference championships when he had a lot of his contributors were freshmen and sophomores, and kind of seeing, his recruits age up and just turn into even more talented upperclassmen. So really excited to see what the next few years hold for Cougar swimming and diving for sure. Speaking of teams winning conference titles, Sam, Houston, since our last episode, men's basketball won a trio of games against SMU, Memphis, and Tulane, which clinches them at least a share of the AAC regular season title for the fourth time in five seasons, extends their winning streak to eight games, improves their overall record to 26-2. Cougars have, at this point, the best record in the country. They're number one in the AP poll again, and in basically every metric. I think at this point, I'd probably take two losses at least down the stretch for Houston to not be a one seed in the NCAA tournament and quite possibly the betting favorite to win the whole thing. And, this is a March Madness that is maybe the most anticipated sporting event, at least for me personally, of my Cougar fandom. And we're down to now a mere three games of regular season remaining before we get into March. First round of the Atlantic Sun Tournament is on Monday with a bunch more conferences starting on Tuesday. We're just right absolutely knocking on the door of March at this point. I'm having a really hard time sitting still. I'm so excited, but also really excited that the Cougs took care of business in these last three games, including beating the second and third place teams in the American reasonably comfortably at home, and kind of putting to bed some of those concerns about Houston's home form and making it easy. I know the team is certainly going to be focusing on their last three games of the regular season, but making it as a fan maybe a little bit easier to kind of peek ahead towards the postseason.
Yeah, right now, Dustin, there are people out there doing podcasts about ostensibly their college's basketball team who aren't talking about them clinching their conference championship on February 22nd, or clinching a share, excuse me, of the conference championship February 22nd. It's basically us and Colgate right now with respect to all the Colgate podcasters. out there. It really just is the rarefied air that Cougar men's basketball kind of is right now. And you got through three games that I think, for very different reasons, you really didn't want to lose. You didn't want to lose to SMU because, I mean, one, SMU's just got awful this year, even relative to recent standards. But that's the closest thing you have to kind of an in-state regional rival in this conference. Memphis, don't really need to, I think, fully state why you don't want to take a second straight home loss to Memphis to end that probably all-time head-to-head for a good long while. And didn't want to lose to Tulane, even though Tulane is probably the most respectable it's been in men's basketball in our time following Cougar sports generally and matching up more years than not with the Green Wave. But didn't want to end that head-to-head last home regular season matchup losing to Ron Hunter, who's made his feel, or at least in the past, probably some of us lately, made his feelings known about Cougar men's basketball. But I think really proved yourself in all of those. I'm not going to say all three were perfect performances. I think certainly the way you closed out against SMU and Memphis gave some people some heartburn, certainly gave at least some small segment of the fan base reason to complain about it. But you won three games. You won them all to varying degrees of convincing. And I think really proved some stuff about yourself. Really proved, I think, that this team maybe hasn't been playing its best basketball in the last month, but I think they've given you some indicator that this team is going to round into form in March. This team is going to start putting another gear like Kelvin Sampson's teams always do this time of year. I really think some of what you saw against Memphis, some of what you saw against SMU, and some of what you saw against Tulane, a lot of what you saw against Tulane, I think really shows you a team that's playing on a different level than all but a handful of teams in the sport right now. Say what you will about the AAC, I think the underlying metrics would tell you this is a fantastic basketball team that I think is going to start playing its best basketball, which is a very scary thought for what's been a team that I think has been the advanced analytics number one and for a few weeks, the polls number one for this regular season. I think that's the really exciting takeaway for me, Dustin, kind of leaving this week and looking back on the three games that we played and looking at the three games left to go in the regular season.
Yeah, so to take those last three games chronologically, Houston got the win up in Dallas against SMU, 80-65 final. It's kind of funny. In the first meeting, Houston won 87-53, and we said at the time with Jerick Phelps playing nowhere close to 100%, and with the rematch coming in Dallas, we expected this game to be a bit more competitive. And, you know, it's kind of that rare moment where sports actually behaved in the logical, linear way you'd kind of expect. Houston's point total dropped from 87-80. SMU's rose from 53-65. You know, Phelps was clearly SMU's best player. He made the Mustangs more competitive. In the first game, Houston delivered the knockout blow in the first 10 minutes of the game. This time it came in the next 10 minutes, the last 10 minutes of the first half. But in the grand scheme of things, Houston was just still the clearly superior team and just never really was in danger of winning the game. So it rarely happens that games just kind of go the way you expect them to, but yeah, hey, this one will be a little bit closer, but Houston's going to still be superior. That's pretty much exactly the way it played out, and the Cougs got a road victory without having to sweat it out too much.
Yeah, I think of all the concerns of the past three games, I think the most overblown and irrelevant ones came from that win last Thursday night in Dallas. Hopefully, the last regular season conference game we'll ever have to talk about involving SMU. They kept it close for the first 10 minutes or so. Cougars gradually pulled away, extended that lead to double digits in the closing minutes of the first half, and they never relinquished that. I realize that you did lead by as much as 23 in the second half. SMU, to their credit, didn't give up on this one, cut it to as few as 11 points, the Cougar lead, but didn't really get any more interesting than that, thankfully, and the Cougars ended this one with a 15-point win for hopefully the last time on the floor of Moody Coliseum. And it's not as extreme as, I guess, Tulsa, but I think facing an opponent the level of SMU, which is to say some degree of below-average Division I basketball team, I think at least somewhat caps the number of meaningful takeaways versus the two opponents that you saw subsequent to this one, which I think are considerably better basketball teams. It was nice to see Marcus Sasser playing back in his old stomping grounds in the DFW Metroplex. I think he really showed how good he can be when the Cougars really need it. Had a quiet first half while other guys really shined in the first 20 minutes, but when the Cougars went a bit colder in the second half, I thought Sasser really carried the team, and more than any other individual, I think really prevented SMU from making this one any more interesting than it ended up actually being down the stretch. I mean, I do get the frustration with the free throw shooting. It was not fun to watch this team brick about half of its free throw attempts, but credit to Tremont Mark, who I think in a lot of really any other measurable offensive facet did not have a good game against the Ponies, I thought he at least gave you reliable free throw shooting on a night where nobody other than Marcus Sasser really gave you on an individual level. And I think maybe that's the frustrating thing about the free throw shooting is that we've seen, I mean, heck, we just saw one game later, that this team isn't always going to be the worst free throw shooting team. I think, not that it would be frustrating if this team struggled shooting free throws, but I think if this team was less up and down, I think if we didn't see games like the subsequent one against Memphis where the Cougars made nearly everything and you had big men being nearly perfect from the line with a number of trips, I think it's just frustrating to see, okay, this team can hit 85-90% some nights, and then you have nights like SMU where you're not even hitting a 60. I think that volatility, that's a little frustrating, though. I think I've said it here before, and I'm going to say it again here. Maybe it's a little bit of wish casting on my part, but I really do think we're starting to see some progression to the mean there. I really do think this is a team that's going to finish the season closer to the 160s or 170s in terms of free throw percentage among all Division I programs. I think they're still underperforming where they could be there, and I think maybe that helps you down the stretch win a close game that otherwise your free throw shooting in the past hasn't been the best. You know, maybe that helps you win the next game that's like Temple. Not to remind people of a game that is very frustrating, one of your two blemishes this year, but I mean, you shoot average from the free throw line against Temple. You're not talking about that being your lone conference blemish at this point. Maybe down the stretch you're better in that tight situation where really just nothing else is happening offensively. You run into a team in the postseason who really has kind of figured you out defensively, like a few teams have this year. So it made SMU frustrating, but I don't think you can make that a takeaway, because I think you saw subsequently this team really do what it needed to do. I think just kind of underlining the volatility of what the team does in that area. My only other big takeaway, Dustin, is I might have watched that Jairus Walker dunk 100 times since I saw it live. I think he had a really solid performance against an SMU team that I'm sure, after what he did to them in January, had a better plan for him than the first time these teams met. I think you saw the pride of guys like F.A. Odighi and Samuel Williams, and guys who have been playing 3 or 4 years of college ball, not wanting this freshman to punk them two games in a row. And I thought Jairus did well, considering that kind of extra attention he got, and considering he didn't really shoot well from the field. I think he just still impacted winning in a number of ways for this team.
Yeah, you mentioned it. Marcus Sasser playing really well up in DFW. That sick Jairus Walker dunk. Only other player I wanted to mention was Jamal Shedd, who was really strong in this one. 13 points, 8 assists, 2 steals. Just one turnover, kind of doing the Jamal Shedd things that you expect him to do to be the steady hand leading the ship for the Cougs there. So, yeah, I mean, only nits you can really pick is that, like you said, Houston missed 10 free throws in this one. They were pretty kind of middling for much of the second half. But ultimately, there's really only so many nits that you should pick with a road win in which the outcome was never really in doubt by kind of the mid to late first half.
Can I have some last U of H SMU head-to-head stuff, Dustin, real quick on the way out?
Go for it.
After this one, UH has a 58-34 all-time record against the Ponies. More recently, the Cougars have won 10 of the last 12 games between these teams. UH's most 5 recent wins have been by double digits, but this is my favorite stat, Dustin. Shout out to sportsreference.com's college basketball matchup finder for allowing me to kind of visualize this little nugget. So since the 2017-2018 season, Dustin, UH's first NCAA tournament team under Kelvin Sampson, the Cougars and Ponies have met 12 times in a regular season or conference tournament game. In those 12 games, U of H has been a top 25 ranked team of some kind for 10 of the last 12 meetings. Dustin, in the 92-game history of this series, how many times do you think SMU has ever been ranked against the Cougars?
One.
A little better than that. They were ranked 9 times ever. U of H has been ranked more against this opponent just since 2018 than SMU ever has. Different levels of program, which is why very happy to leave them behind. In the American, I guess that's my last thought. This wasn't the cleanest finish of the game, but you just can't get too worked up over, I think, what ended up being a 15-point win. I think you sound kind of spoiled when you start nitpicking 15-point road wins too much.
And then the Cougs came home and kept their winning ways going with a 72-64 victory over Memphis. And the big story pregame in this one was that Kendrick Davis ended up not playing due to injury. And while Memphis ended up putting up a good fight, especially in the second half, you know, but every time they made a run, Houston, you know, countered to keep this one out of reach. And obviously it's impossible to say how this one might have turned out if Kendrick Davis had played, just like it's impossible to say if Memphis would have beaten Houston during the regular season last year had Marcus Sasser and Shamon Mark been healthy. So I'm going to spend exactly as much time worrying about the hypothetical universe in which Kendrick Davis is healthy for this game, as, you know, Memphis fans probably spent last year worrying about our guys not being available, which is to say zero. So, you know, as for the game that actually happened, you know, after we talked in the preview about how Memphis was taking better care of the ball than they have in years past, the Cougs came out and forced 14 turnovers in the first half alone, ended up with a 22-8 edge in points off of turnovers that covers Houston's margin of victory and then some. Eight different Cougs had a steal in this game. And yes, it was a game that Memphis prevented Houston from really fully putting this one to bed until the closing minutes, but it was also a game where Houston took a big lead into halftime and kept their opponent at arm's length for the entire second half. Sam, you were obviously at the game with me, so you can tell me if you agree or not, but being there, the feeling that I had in the second half when Memphis would make a run was something like, ugh, they're just being annoying and refusing to go quietly. But it was never really, I don't think, passed over to like, oh my God, we might lose this game.
Yeah, I think they got down to like 4 or 5 with a few minutes left. And maybe at that point, I'm not going to say my thoughts were entirely like, oh no, please don't have this be my one trip back for a game this year. But yeah, I think, like you, I felt more like they're not going to go away quietly, rather than, oh my God, I think we're about to blow this one. Like you said, great to be back in person at the Fertitta Center. Really was a great crowd, a Cougar win that maybe at times gave us a little more heartburn. I think we were maybe hoping against hope for a repeat of that second half and the Cougars running away with this one by 20 or 25 points. But I think if we're all giving ourselves truth here, and we probably knew it was going to be a bit tougher of a finish than it was a start, but still a game UH never trailed, a game that UH largely controlled the proceedings of. And I think we all would have taken this kind of win, knowing how last year's matchup between these teams went, and knowing how much I think all of us didn't want to see this series end on two straight home losses. And I'm going to kind of echo what you said. I'm not saying Memphis wouldn't have been better for Kendrick Davis's presence. I think it would be silly to suggest that this version of Memphis basketball wasn't affected by Kendrick Davis's absence. But Dustin, you can't see me, but I'm rubbing my fingers together and playing the world's tiniest violin that Memphis didn't have their star guard after U of H played this same program 3 times last year without Sasser or Mark. And I actually thought, after watching 40 minutes of that Memphis team without Kendrick Davis versus the team I'd seen in previous games this season, I thought that was a dramatically better Memphis team than most of what I've seen from them this year. Guys like Alex Lomax, Elijah McCadden, Keontae Kennedy, I think, give you a lot more defensively from the guard position than Davis, who's a truly elite scorer. But obviously, you know, that loss lowers your ceiling dramatically on the offensive end, but I think it actually raises your ceiling a bit defensively. Don't think it's a coincidence that this ended up being one of Memphis's better, at least in terms of opponent point output, defensive efforts in a while, despite facing what I think is certainly the best offensive team U of H has had since Kelvin Sampson's been here. And I think you saw in that first half how good this Cougar team can be at creating havoc defensively, at turning an opponent over. And I think how much Memphis missed the stability that Kendrick Davis provided at point guard versus previous seasons, what we talked about in the preview, basically, that Davis had helped to some degree fix their most consistent Achilles heel, being super turnover prone. And I mean, Memphis was on pace for 30 turnovers at halftime. That probably wasn't going to sustain that for an entire game, but yeah, I think you kind of saw them start to figure things out a bit with Alex Lomax running the point for his first game back after a long injury layoff. But I think a lot of this season's story has been the depth of high-level offensive ability on this Cougar team. And I think also Sunday was a reminder that, yes, this is the best offensive team we've ever seen in this program under Kelvin Sampson, but this team still has an unbelievably high ceiling defensively as well, and how good this Cougar team can be taking advantage of an opponent that is being careless with the basketball, like Memphis certainly was in the first half. It was kind of a defense-creating offense game, because really, other than Jawan Robertson, I guess I would say Marcus Sasser too down the stretch, I don't know if you saw any other dominant offensive performances. I mean, I remember this moment, Dustin, you probably remember it too. After a few minutes in the game, Roberts got 2 quick buckets and Hardaway immediately and just emphatically jerked his arm towards the bench and subbed out his son and Chandler Lawson, and brought in their shot blocking specialist, Keo Akabundu Ayogu, to try and just get somebody out there who would do a better job matching Roberts' physicality. And I don't want to sound like a broken record, because I think it's a takeaway we've had a number of times about this player, Dustin, but I also don't want any of us to take for granted this unbelievable leap that Roberts has made, that we're talking about for not close to the first time in this current season about what a positive offensive game changer is, and certainly not for the last time. You know, we're going to talk about Jawan Robertson a little bit in the next home game, and after that, it was really amazing after that abysmal SMU free throw shooting performance to go 23 of 26 from the line and to have Roberts set the tone by going 8 of 8. I think there's a lot of really incredible stuff about the season, but seeing his individual jump, seeing how much confidence, seeing how much ability he has in the offensive end, I would have been thrilled, Dustin, if you had told me Wani was going to be an 8.5, 9 points a game guy. And I know he's like kind of close to that number, but he's just, the numbers don't tell you the story of how valuable he's been offensively, how much opponents are now game planning for this guy being a real offensive force, a real skilled big man, one of the most skilled big men we've ever seen come through this program, which I don't know is, we're big fans of the guy, but you can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know if I ever thought I'd be saying a sentence, Jaywan Roberts is one of the most skilled and effective big men Kelvin Sampson's ever had here on the offensive end. It's wild.
Yeah, no, I think I was probably above average in terms of my expectations for Jaywan Roberts coming into the season, and he has vastly exceeded even my probably optimistic expectations. And yeah, I was just a man-child in this one. Had what was very briefly a new career high with 20 points, including what you mentioned, the strong performance from the free throw line to go with 12 boards. Marcus Sasser strong as well, 20 points, also strong from the free throw line. And I just really like that Houston matched and exceeded Memphis's physicality and their desire and ability to get to the free throw line. This was what we knew was going to be kind of a big X factor in this one, and the Cougs were able to draw contact to get to the line, and I really liked that Houston made their free throws once they got to the charity stripe. So, you know, again, like I said, certainly some imperfections. Houston struggled early on the glass. They only ended up with 4 second chance points against a team that's ranked in the 300s in defensive rebounding, and the second half defense wasn't the strongest, especially when it came to Elijah McCadden of Memphis, and Cougs not named Marcus Sasser shot 1 of 12 from beyond the arc, but plenty to like as well. You know, get the win. The only realistic path to Houston sweating out the AAC regular season title, even a little bit, was going to be Memphis pulling off the road upset in this one. And despite what I think was a pretty strong effort by the Tigers, and Houston, I would say, only bringing their maybe B or B-plus game, this one still, you know, reasonably comfortably ends up in the win column.
You know, looking back on it, Dustin, it kind of felt like that second half was... It reminded me sort of what Bama did against the Cougars, albeit, I think, a bit less successfully. They did a lot less of the trying to run sets, and I think just letting the Cougars, I think, do what they do best and defend in the half court. You saw a lot more of the Tigers, especially Elijah McCadden, really challenging the Cougars one-on-one, I think, more successfully, especially Alex Lomax, pushing tempo and maybe making the game run at a pace more to Memphis's liking. And Memphis's players, in addition to being, I would say, and this is the nice thing I'm going to say about them, very good actors, let's be real. They did a good job putting the officials, I think, in the second half in position to make calls. They forced U of H to sit some guys here and there. I think Jamal Shedd and Tremont Mark specifically because of foul trouble resulting, I think, from them being a bit more aggressive. And it also felt like at times in that second half on offensive possessions, U of H was trying to slow the game down, which I think you understand. You're trying to do the opposite of what your opponent's doing. You're trying to play the game slow, which isn't really Memphis's most comfortable speed. But there are also a number of those second half possessions where it just felt like U of H was running the clock down to 5 or 6 seconds, and then nobody was open, and nobody seemed to have a clear idea of how to get open that quickly. It kind of, again, it didn't get that close. It never got that level of anxiety, but it kind of brought back some of the bad memories of the Bama loss. And I think Sampson said in his postgame comments that they really had to work on, as a team, dealing with when an opponent does what Bama did previously, what Memphis did in this one, then they really want to go downhill, really just try to take you on one-on-one. And their team, like Memphis, that I think isn't necessarily common in the AAC, and the fact that they have guards who are able to do that. Dustin, with all respect to the ECU team that we're going to be previewing here in several minutes, ECU does not have the horses to do that kind of strategy, but Memphis does, and I think the Cougars, as the big postseason games come up, I think need to start figuring that one out. But even in that second half where you struggled, it was still great to see U of H do stuff on the margins well, like make their free throws. I thought they did a good job specifically attacking Alex Lomax and DeAndre Williams, two of Memphis's most critical veterans and two guys who spent most of the second half in foul trouble. And Dustin, as a big-time Memphis hater, I enjoyed a lot of things about being the Fertitta Center, but it was chicken soup for my soul to see 26-year-old-ass DeAndre Williams stomping around like a toddler after he committed that end-of-the-shot-clock foul after Memphis had cut the lead back to single digits. I really do think later on, Memphis's last hope of winning this game really evaporated when he fouled out, which is over a minute left. Tremont Mark goes to the free throw line, extends it to 7. I think truly in person, that's where I took that deep exhale. I was like, okay, we're not going to find a way to lose this game. So not a perfect win, but man, such a relief to know that no matter what happens in the next month or so, we're not going to end this series on back-to-back home losses to Penny Hardaway.
And then if the SMU and Memphis games were a little bit too close for your liking, surely Tulane, the Tulane game was more what you wanted as a spoiled Cougar fan. The Cougs win this one 89-59. Green Wave spent about 7 or 8 minutes pretending like they might threaten to finally give Ron Hunter his first victory against Kelvin Sampson. They came out of the gates hot. They hit their first three shots. But even early on, we saw, you know, the reason that Ron Hunter never beats Houston, which is that, you know, Houston always clobbers Tulane on the boards. And that happened again in this one. Houston also won the turnover battle in a big way. And eventually, you know, Tulane didn't keep making all their shots like they did with the first few out of the gates. And as soon as that happened, the route was kind of on. And man, talk about another ridiculous game by Juwan Roberts. Tulane could not remotely handle him. He was 9 of 10 from the floor. Another 8 of 9 performance from the free throw line for a new career high. 26 points. And kind of like you said, it's just been remarkable watching him go from, you know, last year being literally the single Cougar who took the fewest shots per minute of anybody on the team. It was a total offensive afterthought to, you know, kind of early this year seeing that he could actually be a solid offensive piece to now late in the year. Seeing him develop the confidence and his seeing his teammates develop the confidence in him for him to just be a genuine offensive star, someone who opposing coaches have to make a central part of their game plan on that end of the floor, someone who's a real offensive focal point who opens things up for his teammates.
He was the guy, Dustin, who if he dribbled it more than 2 or 3 times before this season, you were just like, buddy, pass to somebody else. Nothing good is going to happen here. And I'm not trying to be mean because there were things he did well. I'm not saying I didn't want Juwan Roberts on the floor for all the other things he did well, but it was not offense that he was on the floor for, at least until this season. Yeah, just was very apparent very early in this one. There was nobody Tulane had who could even come close to checking Roberts. And I really do think it was that first minute or two that you knew, even as Tulane hit shots early on, that this was going to be a tough night for them when the Cougars had 4 offensive rebounds in their first 3 possessions. And I think it's worth noting, this was a Tulane team coming in with the second best conference record. They're coming in on a 5-game winning streak that included wins over Memphis and Cincy. Their lowest offensive output over that streak was 74 points in a blowout win over SMU. And to go from a team doing that to this game, which quite frankly was never really in doubt for the final 27, 28-ish minutes of game action, I think that's a really impressive performance. And that's, you said it, it's kind of been the story of UH versus Tulane under Ron Hunter, because that's just not a program that puts much of an emphasis on getting offensive rebounds. And also not really one with a lot of guys who could even, if he did emphasize that, physically match what U of H does in that department. If you're going to give this Cougar team 18 second chances at the basket, Dustin, I think that makes an already difficult task of beating this team basically impossible. You had 4 different Cougars with at least 3 offensive rebounds, with Jairus Walker leading the way with 5 himself, eventually having a career-high 13 total boards. And it was also pretty apparent early on that Tulane wasn't just missing the front court horses, but like I said, they had nobody who could check Juwan Roberts. I think you can't say enough. 26 points, 7 boards, 3 assists, and 2 steals. But to add that line to the context of him, he didn't even play more than 26 minutes in this one, Dustin. The per minute on that is absolutely absurd. And I think that certainly puts this performance on the short list of really, really good Cougar individual offensive showings this season. He was nearly perfect from the free throw line after being perfect against Memphis. Juwan Roberts going, Dustin, from being, I would say, arguably your worst free throw shooter in the rotation, it's probably him or Chaney last year, to currently shooting 73% from the line. It's not number one because there's just so many cool things about his season, but it's high up on the list of just cool 1 year to the next development things we've seen Roberts do. And you saw this Cougar guard group for not the first time take on Jalen Cook and Jalen Forbes. And I know Cook's final stat line this one looks good. He had 23 points. The efficiency numbers don't look terrible. But if you actually watch this game, I think you'd know that not much of that Jalen Cook offense came at any meaningful time of the game. He got a shot here or there, but you never saw him take over this game. You never saw him do what, quite frankly, he does against every other AAC opponent. And he just didn't have what it took to really take on Marcus Sasser, Jamal Shedd, and company, who this is a great guard group offensively. I think just you can't say enough about that, but it shouldn't be overlooked that these guys are also junkyard dogs. These guys are also guys who are in their third or later year in a Kelvin Sampson program, so they're going to be as tough as any tough guards out there. I mean, you did see Tulane hang around and keep it around 15, 16 points, but you know, I think you saw the Cougars really find a different level there in the final 7 or 8 minutes, and you just saw Tulane really get worn down, really just have nothing for the Cougars in that final 7 or 8 minutes, and the Cougars just really run away with it and get to that final 30-point margin.
Yeah, I mean, the Jaylens paced Tulane in scoring like you'd expect, but they also had 6 turnovers each, which I think kind of underscores the success that Houston had in this one. Yeah, Marcus Sasser, just, you got to say, excellent in every facet, 22 points, 6 assists, 5 boards, 4 steals, filling up the stat sheet, just 1 turnover. Kelvin Sampson, after the game, campaigned for Sasser to win AAC Player of the Year, and I think the way he's playing right now, he should have that in the bag, but games like this make you realize that I think he's going to receive deservedly major All-American consideration as well, and really, in addition to Wani and Marcus Sasser, I thought every starter contributed in this one for Houston. You know, Tremont Mark, 13 points, 4 steals. Jamal Shedd, 10 points, 6 assists. Jairus Walker, not his most efficient offensive night, still ends up with 9 points and grabs a career high. 13 rebounds. Jairus Juwan, Reggie Chaney, look like between them they could grab just about any rebound that they wanted to in this one. So just overall impressive, dominant performance. Like we said, clinches Houston's 4th straight AAC regular, fourth AAC regular season title in 5 years, 5 straight seasons in which no team will win more American Athletic Conference games than the Cougs. And you know, it's almost a little bit like unsexy to get excited about an AAC championship, both because, you know, this year's team's expectations are much more than the AAC title, and because, you know, even in terms of conference specific ambitions, we're all much more focused on the future and competing in the Big 12 compared to, you know, winning the American again. And, you know, it was also kind of an AAC title that was, you know, largely a foregone conclusion that we kind of knew that Houston was always going to be the heavy, heavy favorite to win. You know, but winning conference championships is good. There's a reason why they put conference titles on banners. And, you know, in so much as the season will largely be defined by Houston's NCAA tournament run, if you're hoping for a high seed while playing in a mediocre conference, the way you do that is play extremely well, beat some good teams in non-conference. Houston did that. And then, you know, you step two, create very clear separation between yourself and the rest of your mediocre conference foes. And Houston has now done that as well with a 14-1 record and clinching the title with 3 games to go.
Yeah, I want to win this title as long as we're in this league. Is it going to excite me as much as the thought of playing Big 12 basketball and competing for that title next year? No, but as long as we're here, as long as we're playing for that championship, I certainly don't want the last year of U of H being in this league to be the year we don't win it for the first time in a few years. And like you said, I think just you want to prove you're a cut above this pretty mediocre conference. I think do what the Cougars have done for 14 of the 15 conference games they've played so far. And I think really impressive that, again, it's February 23rd. There are multiple regular season games left, Dustin, and we're talking about a team that has at least clinched a share, and I think functionally it's just a matter of time before they've got it out right here in the next week or so.
Yeah, so a game that will likely lead to that outcome is on Saturday when the Cougs will travel to East Carolina. You know, pretty wild that even at this juncture, Houston already having clinched a share of the title. There's still an AAC team that Houston hasn't faced yet this year, and that team is the Pirates of VCU. These are one of the 2 teams, along with USF, that Houston only plays once in conference play. So if you were hoping to see them at the Fertitta Center one last time, that's too bad, but we do get one more showdown in Greenville. And in terms of recent history, you know, on the one hand, Houston has won 10 of the last 11 matchups between these teams, with 4 of those wins coming by 30 plus points, including last year's 79-36 demolition job at the Fertitta Center. However, the last time these teams played in Greenville, that was 2 years ago, and that was the 1 out of 11 that Houston didn't win, with the Pirates pulling a stunning upset. So, you know, guys like Marcus Sasser, Tremont Mark, Jamal Shedd, Reggie Chaney, and Juwan Roberts may well remember that game and remind some of the other guys about what happened the last time that Houston traveled to Greenville. But obviously some differences between this matchup and that one. You know, number one, Jaden Gardner ain't walking through that door. You know, and even though this version of ECU has a better conference record, the metrics would tell you that it's a weaker team overall than the one that beat the Cougs a couple years ago. 14-13 overall, 5-9 mark in AAC play. Started out 1-6, actually. They have since beaten Tulsa twice, as well as grabbing narrow home victories over SMU and Cincinnati. So yeah, they have won 4 of their last 7. They've won 3 of their last 4 at home. But, you know, 3 of those 4 wins have come against, you know, very bad Tulsa and SMU teams. And, you know, basically all 4 of their wins, I think, boil down to, you know, very close wins against teams that just aren't that good. You know, Cincinnati's, I think, decent, but not amazing. And, you know, mix those in with, you know, while you've been winning four of the last seven, those three losses in there have been losses to Wichita, USF, and SMU, all teams outside the top 100. And they've lost those three games by an average margin of over 12 points. So, Sam, I think even applying the, hey, remember that we lost a Temple level of humility here, I think this is an ECU team that is significantly worse than Temple, and I think that they're significantly worse than the ECU team that beat Houston a couple of years ago. So, I don't know, just have a hard time taking this one too seriously.
Yeah, I will say when I took a quick look at the Pirates in the preseason, I thought they had the potential to be what Tulsa actually ended up being this year, which is to say, a team firmly rooted to the bottom of the standings, the first-year head coach, really bad win-loss record, really lacking roster. And I think to the credit of their head coach, Mike Schwartz, a guy before this who was a longtime Rick Barnes assistant at Tennessee and other places, despite going into the season with one of the least experienced rosters in all Division I, it's a team that's coming in as one of five conference wins and will almost certainly finish with an overall record that's somewhere at least close to 500. Those are very modest achievements, but considering this coach didn't go for the quick fix of lots of older D1 transfers, only some JUCO, I'd say it's a successful first season considering the expectations, considering how young the team is. And I know Cincy and Wichita State are not even in the ballpark of the best recent Cincy and Wichita State teams, but I think this ECU program where they are, I think beating those two teams that are a lot higher in the standings, I think it shows something. But I think we got to get to the reality here. This team has not been better than well below average at anything offensively this year besides offensive rebounding and getting to the free throw line, which those aren't too small things, but when you're 256th or worse in the country at both types of field goal percentage, free throw percentage, effective field goal percentage, turnover percentage, getting your shot blocked, I think it's going to make it a very difficult evening to get points against this Cougar team. Getting those second chances, like I said, this is a good offensive rebounding team. That's going to help, and while U of H is elite themselves at grabbing offensive rebounds, it maybe can be the Cougars a bit susceptible sometimes against better offensive rebounding opponents, but it's just hard to see how ECU is going to overcome struggling that badly at shooting the basketball against this Cougar team. And I think most importantly, which I'm going to get to here, doing it without the two guys who I think have gotten the most reps at point guard this season. And I think it's impressive that ECU has gotten to five wins without Javon Small, their leading scorer by a good margin, one of the more prolific assist guys in the country before he got hurt back in January. Actually, Small was a holdover from the last staff. Went from being a guy who was end of the bench on last year's team to very much their top option, calling his own number, their top distributor. And I don't have any specific inside information, but I did see Schwartz answering a question earlier today where he said, quote, it's still an unknown for Small coming back, which, who knows, might just be a smokescreen for him coming back for ECU's biggest game of the season, but I don't know. That, to me, didn't sound like a guy who's on the verge of coming back to play. Also, freshman Caleb LeCount, one of the guys who's filled in at point for Small, has missed most of the last four games. We'll say, I'm interested to see how the Cougars match up with their front court. Very young, but Brandon Johnson and Ezra Assauer are both, I think, skilled big men in different ways. Johnson's more of a stretch four. Assauer's more of your typical post player who's going to be, I think, an interesting guy to watch in that program long-term, but I think bottom line, I'm sure Minji's Coliseum will be absolutely packed and raucous, and ECU certainly can get a big crowd for a big game, but this isn't going to be the first time U of H gets that road reception. This isn't going to be certainly close to the best opponent U of H has had to overcome a difficult road atmosphere against this year. So I don't know. It's so weird to feel more confident about a team's performances away from home, but I think 11 games this year have given you good reason to believe that U of H, if they're going to finally have a bump on the road, that's going to be against this opponent. Really just have a hard time seeing it. Not saying it's impossible. History would tell me to be maybe a bit more humble than I am, but I have a hard time seeing it.
I was going to say, if you want to try to talk yourself into worrying about this one, you kind of mentioned up top there, the two things that you can really give yourself are that ECU hits the offensive glass hard and they get to the line a lot. And those are two areas where Houston has been at least semi-vulnerable at times this year is, you know, opponents getting to the line a lot and hitting the offensive glass. But if you want to not worry about this game, like kind of like you said, also look at basically any other aspect of ECU's statistical profile. They turn it over. They don't force turnovers. That's right there. That's a recipe for disaster against this Cougar team. They don't shoot well at any level. Leading per-game scorer Javon Small, like you mentioned, out for over a month at this point. Unclear if or when he's going to return this year. So, yeah, I don't know. It's just hard to see ECU preventing the Cougs from reaching the high 70s or 80s in terms of points scored. And, you know, you've got, you know, front court scorer in the front court and the back court with Brandon Johnson and RJ Felton, respectively. But just doesn't seem like the Pirates are real likely to score enough points to hang with the Cougs.
Pretty fundamental flaw there, I would say.
Yeah. All right, moving on to women's hoops. The Cougs also played three games since we last spoke to y'all, but a significantly less successful three games, going 1-2, kind of dampening any hopes of the Cougs proving to be the number two team in this conference behind USF. They did win their rematch against the pesky Temple team up in Philly, which is admirable, but they sandwiched that one in between a pair of games in which they just kind of missed some golden opportunities to finish off games against Memphis and ECU, the two teams who are Houston's competition for second place in the conference, and in doing so dropped both of those games. So started with a home matchup against Memphis last Wednesday, and early on things seemed to be going well. The Cougs played a shutdown defense in the first half, even though they weren't exactly red hot themselves. They still took a 26-14 lead into the half, but Houston only scored 6 third quarter points, allowing the Tigers to pull within 6. And then in the fourth quarter, the Cougs couldn't hold on to the lead. Became a back and forth game in the closing minutes, with Memphis hitting a 3 to take a 1-point lead with 22 seconds to go. And then after that, down 1 with 22 seconds to go in the final 22 seconds, Houston missed a 3-pointer, a putback layup, and 2 free throws to let that Memphis 1-point lead stand. Just a brutal ending to a game that Houston should have had and had in that point. And you know, when you lose 45-44, you generally start with the offense, and the Cougs were pretty woeful there. The frequent 3-point struggles of this team this year cropped up. They shot 3 of 18 as a group, only attempted 8 free throws, which, I don't know, may have been a good thing given that they only made 3 out of those 8, but just really nobody played well. Tierra Young, Brittany Onige, 11 and 10 points respectively to lead the teams, but it took them 16 and 12 shots respectively to get there, and the Cougs just got killed on the glass, allowed Memphis to rebound over half their misses, and got out-rebounded by 15 overall. So, Sam, I know just very frustrating to lose a crucial game that, A, you had a big lead in for much of the game, and B, you didn't have to play that well. You just couldn't shoot dreadfully at all three levels and get killed on the boards. But Houston did all of those things.
And we knew this would be a defensive struggle. I don't think it was necessarily a surprise that it was low scoring. But if you had told me we held Memphis to 45 points, I would have felt reasonably good about us winning. So I would have felt like, okay, then it was a 51-45 final. Actually, live, Dustin, we had some friends come visit us out here. And I watched the first half. Left with us having a 12-point lead at halftime. I was like, okay, we've got this in hand. I really, really expected to open my phone a few hours later and say, okay, we won by some margin. When I saw 45-44, I did a double take. I was like, we really blew all that lead and just watched it. And it's just, it's like, it's a new game. It's a new opponent, but it feels like watching the exact same thing play out that's played out in several other games this year. The Cougars just kind of completely losing it offensively, not just having kind of a cold patch, but just having a several minutes of having no idea how to even run a functional college offense kind of problems. I mean, we're going to get to it in the ECU game, but a lot of bad possessions, a lot of a team that looked like it didn't have a clear idea of what it wanted to do. And to be in a situation where you're down 1, miss 2 free throws in the closing seconds that could have either tied or won the game, missed on another possession. You had chances to win this. And just to once again, for not even close to the first time this year, come up short in such a close game. That's kind of the vibes this week. The vibes are really bad. I feel like when I put together my thoughts for this, it felt differently. I don't think in our history of covering this program on this show have I felt this way about past week's action. It's not that I haven't been frustrated before, and it's not that this team can't ever lose. It's not that I have some kind of weird expectation that this, oh, because the men are number 1, this team should be number 1 too. But I think I'm paying this group of young women the highest compliment possible when I say I think they're a lot better than losing at home and scoring 44 points against Memphis. I'm sorry, that's harsh, but I absolutely believe this group has no business losing to that team. I know Memphis is a better AAC team, but that was a game you had to have. You were just riding this golden wave from that really gutsy, no one thought you'd get it win over USF, and to go go back out there against this opponent who you're really directly vying for position at the top of the conference behind USF for, and to lose this game this way, really, really frustrating.
Yeah. The Cougs did rebound with a 56-48 win over Temple, completing the season sweep of the Owls after the comeback victory at the First Hita Center a couple weeks ago. And they managed it despite another lackluster offensive performance. Houston made less than a quarter of their shots from the field in this one, but forced 24 turnovers and had a 15-6 edge in second chance points to help them pull out the W. And after that woeful free throw shooting against Memphis, they responded nicely, both in terms of frequency and getting to the line and in actually making the shots. They were 17 of 22 from the charity stripe. Turns out I like missing 5 free throws a lot better when it's out of 22 attempts rather than when it's out of 8. So definitely, Sam, a nice road win for the Cougs to bounce back a little bit.
Yeah, didn't shoot the ball well, but obviously, like this team generally does, played good defense, and I think really enjoyed this team being able to kind of go against Tennessee and actually get to the charity stripe, which hasn't always been the easiest thing, and obviously, very importantly, make those and allow this game that you absorbed, I think, Temple's best effort there in the fourth quarter to kind of try to get back in this one and make it close. But I thought the Cougars did a good job keeping this one from ever getting too scary. I wish I was gonna say that about more than one game from this past week, though. I think a good, admirable performance, and I think showcasing what this team is capable of doing, which is playing really good defense and going into a road environment getting the win. But unfortunately, the only such time we could say that about this past week.
And say, Britt Onyedjeh, the one efficient score for the Cougs in this one, 4 of 8 from the floor for 15 points. Tidiana Hill struggled shooting the ball, but led the team with 11 rebounds, 5 steals, and 3 blocks. Actually leads the Cougs in all 3 of those categories on the year as well. So no gimme, but glad to see the Cougs go on the road, get a win to make sure that the slide over the past week and a half wasn't any worse than it was. Because that game, like we said, was sandwiched in between the Memphis game and then Houston blowing another late lead to lose to East Carolina in triple overtime, 88-83. Houston led by as many as 12 points in the fourth quarter, led 61-52 with under 3 minutes to play in regulation, but froze up down the stretch, let ECU tie it up in the final 20 seconds, and instead of even managing to attempt a game winner, Houston turned it over. ECU actually missed a narrow would-be winner at the buzzer, and then the Cougs came out strong in the first overtime period as well, led by 5 with under 90 seconds to go, but once again couldn't close out the Pirates, gave up a lightning quick 7-0 run, and then needed a Cameron Jones jumper in the closing seconds to tie it up and send it to a second overtime. Second overtime, Cougs actually came from behind themselves, but missed another chance to win as Tatiana Hill only hit 1 of 2 free throws, with Houston trailing by 1 in the closing seconds, tying but not winning the game for Houston. And then by the third overtime, the war of attrition finally favored the Pirates. Houston ended up having 4 players foul out in this one, including key players like Layla Blair, Britt Onyedjeh, Tatiana Hill. The Cougs managed to score just 3 points in the third overtime period to take the loss. So, remarkable game in a lot of ways. Remarkable in that Houston has now played 5 overtime games this year, which is more than anybody else in the country, and they've won just 1 of those. And it's remarkable that Bria Patterson set a school record with 54 minutes played in this one and scored a career-high 27 points to go with 6 steals and was just overall really, really good in a losing effort. But like I said, hard not to talk about this, especially after the Memphis game, and see that, you know, Houston failed to close out yet another game from a winning position, and now find themselves a game behind ECU and Memphis for second place in the American.
Yeah, and to have a 12-point lead with just over 5 minutes left, to have a 9-point lead, Dustin, with just under 3 minutes left, but to not make a single basket for the remainder of that fourth quarter, that's what we talked about earlier. That's this team going from functional offensive team to just unable to do anything, turning the ball over, lots of possessions, just to not even be able to close out that level of lead is very frustrating. And to be in a position where not just blowing that lead, but giving your opponent, like you mentioned, a chance to actually win it in regulation after having a 9-point lead with just under 3 minutes left, I think really frustrating. Blowing a 5-point lead with just over a minute left in the first overtime and needing that Cameron Jones make, like you said, with 7 seconds left to even get this one to a second overtime, and just really had a chance, even after the loss to Memphis, really had a chance to put yourself in decent position to be the number 2 team in this league, well and truly, you know, leave that bad start to the year in non-conference in the past, leave the bad game against Memphis in the past, to get a road win against a team that's one of the most improved in the country this year, and just to let it slip through your fingers like that, I think very frustrating. You had two chances this past week against two of the other teams you were directly fighting with to be that number two team in the league behind USF, and that you found a way to lose both from a winning position is very, very disheartening. And this, again, this isn't me feeling like I'm entitled to a top five program because of the men's team, because, you know, just be frank, the programs aren't resourced on the same level. And I think holding any coach in your department to the same standard as Kelvin Sampson is massively unfair to the other coach, because I think we all don't appreciate how lucky we are that Sampson even ended up at U of H in the first place. But again, I think the best compliment I can pay these young women playing in this program right now is that I don't believe there's any way they should have an 11-15 overall record right now. I don't believe there's any reason they should be just three games above 500 in this conference, where there's only one real team that's close to being an at-large NCAA kind of team. And I hate doing this because I think there are very few people in this athletic department that represent U of H better than Coach Huey. And this program is undeniably a lot better than the one this coach walked into when he got here 9 years ago. But Dustin, this isn't even close to an NCAA tournament team. And I think right now, if U of H can't conceive of being better than this in the AAC with a move to the Big 12 on the horizon, I don't know, man. At some point, that's almost showing that you don't even have a pretense of caring about the sport and being competitive in the sport. And it's frustrating. I think this team should be better. I've seen this team be better, but we saw in two just absolutely critical games the team not find a way to win. And that's tough to swallow. I'm sure it's tougher to swallow for the people in the program, but it's, I don't know, it's tough to swallow as someone who really did believe that this year and this team could be different, and just ultimately just not seeing it.
Yeah, it's been disappointing for sure. It's just some remarkable stat lines in this game, it should be pointed out before we completely move on.
Can I get one positive thing here? I meant to say this.
Go.
Bria Patterson's been awesome. Bria Patterson's awesome in the last month or so. Yeah. I don't think she's been even more awesome than she was against ECU. I don't think this even gets to multiple overtimes without Bria Patterson doing what she did. I hate that I'm essing all over the season and team while Bria Patterson plays the best basketball she's played in her life and just has been really, really joyful to watch. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, as you might expect in a game that went to three overtimes and took place between the top two turnover-forcing teams in the conference, there were some remarkable stat lines. This one, I mentioned the one from Bria Patterson and how she was filling up the box score. Britt Onyejay, 19 points and 8 steals. Tatiana Hill, double-double with 10 points and 14 boards before fouling out. Houston had 22 team steals and forced 31 ECU turnovers, but unfortunately, a pair of Cougs had 8 turnovers apiece as Houston turned it over 30 times as a team. ECU's Micah Dennis nearly misses an extremely unconventional triple-double with 12 assists, 9 turnovers, and 9 points. So, you know, like I said, devoid of context, it's kind of fun to be involved in a wild game like this, but in the context of losing a pair of games that were in your pocket to drop to fourth place in a one-bid league and kind of cement that you're going to finish this season under 500, barring some miracle run through the conference tournament, it's a lot less fun. And like you said, I think it deservedly raises some big questions about the leadership of this program heading into the Big 12 next year. More immediately, Houston has two games remaining in their regular season as they'll be hosting Tulsa on Saturday and Wichita State on Wednesday. And the good news is that Houston can drop no further than to fifth place in the American, meaning that they'll get a first-round bye at the conference tournament regardless of what happens in their last two games. But their chances of jumping back into the top three to avoid facing USF until the finals seems to be pretty thin. They would have to win their remaining two games, and I believe have Memphis lose both of their remaining two games. So both Tulsa and Wichita, Houston's two remaining opponents, have losing conference records. The Golden Hurricane edged out the Cougs by 2 points up in Tulsa, and then the season finale will, weirdly enough, be Houston's first and only contest against Wichita State. So, in all likelihood, the only things that these games really mean is, you know, whether Houston will be the 4 or the 5 seed when they face SMU in the quarterfinals of the conference tournament. But, you know, I think everybody involved is really just playing for pride, Sam. So I guess we'll see what kind of finish to the season Houston has in them.
Yeah, I mean, that game against Tulsa last time was extremely close. I think a game you had a chance to win when these two teams met on the road. I think an interesting matchup in that I think they've cooled down a bit since early in the season, but Tulsa Tulsa is a very offense-forward team. U of H is a very defense-forward team. And I always like those kind of matchups because you're kind of wondering which one of those is going to give. Who's going to make the game kind of get played to their style, whether it's going to be a game played in the 60s, 70s, or 80s like Tulsa wants it, or kind of in the 40s or 50s like probably the Cougars would prefer. Two winnable games, but again, stop me if it sounds familiar, not two games that I just feel like are locks to be Cougar wins, and it's a lock that we're going to come back next week and talk about a 10-5 conference team.
All right, so I do want to move on before we get any further and talk about some Cougar football off-season news, as we got a little bit of surprising news in the past week as Miami hired Houston offensive coordinator Shannon Dawson to take the same job with the Hurricanes out there in Coral Gables. And, you know, just kind of, I think, a surprise move both in the timing of when it happened and just of the fact that, you know, I don't think Houston fans were exactly thrilled with the job that Shannon Dawson had been doing. And I think it is mentioned that there's a little bit of a disconnect in terms of Houston's overall offensive numbers being pretty good last year. But you know, I think a reasonable one, given the fact that Houston just, you know, multiple games last year kind of lost, you know, maybe thanks to some overly conservative offense. And definitely played a string of games against teams not very good on the defensive end, while having an extremely senior laden offense that really, by any rights, should have been a very good offensive team. So it's a move that I think, for a number of reasons, Shannon Dawson's influence on the offense hasn't perceived to be the most positive one. So it's just a move that the Cougar fans are not really sad about, and it's kind of a head scratcher for Miami that, you know, his last two jobs, you know, left Southern Miss and no one there was sad to see him go, and then comes to Houston and leaves Houston where no one is really sad to see him go. So, I guess good for Shannon Dawson for continuing to kind of fail upwards, but, not something that I think is going to upset too many Cougar fans. Already it's been kind of announced that Dana Holgorsen is not going to be looking for a new offensive coordinator, so just kind of taking on, or maybe, you know, reassuming the roles that I think he kind of had towards the end of last year anyway. But yeah, I don't know. Just like I said, it when you have someone hired away, it's supposed to be theoretically disappointing. But I don't think too many Cougar fans really shedding any tears over this one.
I saw the move happen right as I pulled into my parking spot at work, and I was double and triple checking to make sure that wasn't a deep fake Bruce Feldman account. I was like, no, wait, Miami for their offensive coordinator position hired Shannon Dawson? I mean, you said it. This is not a move that was really greeted with any heartbreak from the Cougar fan base, which is to say he presided over a bad offense. And I think you also got to look at the QB coaching perspective. You can't not give him credit for the big steps for the Clayton Tune took in the last two seasons. And I know that kind of development, more than anything, is driven by the work the player is willing to put in. And no one would doubt Clayton Tune has done tons of that. But you've seen it. Tune's publicly praised Dawson often on that front, helping him be a better quarterback. So I want to talk about the subject in good faith. You know, and I want to mention that the Cougar passing offense was the best it's been in a season post Case Keenum, but all the stuff you said is true. And I think it's equally fair to note that, I mean, you'll get some of the performances here. 37 points against UTSA looks good on paper, but three overtime game, and the Cougars spent a whole lot of that game doing nothing against a fine, but not that really great UTSA defense. 30 points against Tech, which really damning, because the offense only scored 20 points in regulation. Seven of those were a pick six touchdown. 30 points against Kansas, who was a better team than they've been in a while, but undeniably very bad defensive team. 34 points against Rice, but you only cleared that marker by a Nelson Caesar fumble return touchdown late in that game. Even the 33 points against Memphis, a game which featured that fourth quarter, which is, I think, one of the best quarters of offense we've seen in recent years, that shouldn't cover up the fact that this offense, with less than 2 minutes left in the game, only had 19 points against a bad Memphis defense. And I think ending the 2022 home slate by only scoring 30 points against a Tulsa team that was one of the very worst defenses we saw play this season in Tank Dell and Clayton Tune's final home games, I think, not great. And I think I've mentioned five specific games where U of H scored 30 points or more, and I think you can see from that how maybe the perception of U of H being, oh, like, I saw these Miami fans, but U of H had a top 25 offense this year. It's like, oh, okay, buddy, good luck. I'm sure you'll be really rational and excited about the Shannon Dawson offensive experience. But I think this also, we shouldn't totally absolve Dana Holgorsen in all this, because he's certainly, even if Dawson was the guy calling the plays, the offense philosophy, that's getting set by Holgorsen. Holgorsen very much has been publicly about, you know, ball control is the way to go and complimentary football, blah, 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 even when it was very clear that this team wasn't capable of doing that on the level he wanted to for about half the season. And functionally, I think wasting a good chunk of the senior season of a good quarterback and a very good wide receiver, which I think is very frustrating. And I think a big reason why Cougar fans are not super sad to see Mr. Dawson go to South Beach. And like you said, doesn't sound like the Cougars are hiring an offensive coordinator, though. It does sound like, though it hasn't, I think, been officially announced yet, that Mike Burchett, one of the team's offensive analysts, will eventually be promoted to quarterbacks coach, but not official yet.
And then speaking of not official, worth noting while we're talking about Houston coordinators, the defensive coordinator Doug Belk has reportedly interviewed with the San Diego Chargers. So hard to know, you know, if he is the favorite or what the likelihood is of him getting that job. Certainly, you know, can't be mad at the guy for being willing to take a NFL DC job. You know, if you leave for the SEC or something for a DC job, you can't even be too mad. If you leave for an NFL DC job, you definitely can't be mad at all, which I think it is kind of interesting, given that he's interviewing for an NFL job when it's another guy who, you know, given the season that Houston had last year defensively, I think he might actually get more kind of mixed feelings than would Shannon Dawson. But, you know, certainly a year ago, if he left, I'd have been very upset. But, you know, the way that he's been played defensively this past year, I think that there's understandably some subset of the Cougar fan base, some subset of me, that would be like, okay, oh darn, like it's a weird time of the offseason to leave. Then that's maybe the frustrating thing more than anything, is if you lose both of your coordinators in frickin' February, that's not the best time to be going out and trying to make hires to replace them if it does come to that. But, you know, I think I did want Doug Belk for another season back, because, you know, I think he showed 2 years ago what he's capable of, and I think, you know, not coming into a season not losing three, you know, high-level NFL talents could make for a bounce-back season for the Cougs defensively heading into next year. But yeah, I don't know. Would be some kind of bizarre, not the best way to be heading into the Big 12 if you head into your first Big 12 season having to replace both of your coordinators, you know, midway through the offseason.
Yeah, I think you took a lot of my points there. I mean, obviously, not going to hold it against the guy. Being a defensive coordinator in the NFL is the pinnacle of the profession. You are never going to find a defensive coordinator at this university in that job, no matter how much this program has a glow up in the next 10, 20 years, that won't be willing to leave for even a bad NFL team's defensive coordinator position, because it's the pinnacle of the profession. And, you know, at least I would say with Doug Belk versus Shannon Dawson, at least Doug Belk had one not super far removed season of putting together a good unit on the field. And I don't know, you could say the same thing about Dawson. And also kind of like you, it's like, eh, well, but the defense really just looked like it didn't have any ideas last year. But I think even with some of my reservations about how last season went, I think it all kind of wins out, and it all kind of goes back to what you said. And I just at this point, this offseason, I prefer not to lose another coordinator. But Shannon Dawson's like, okay, well, I kind of like the idea of a brain trust without Shannon Dawson versus with Shannon Dawson. But I think I'd much rather have Doug Belk here, even with some of the consternation from what was, I think, a pretty below par defense last year.
All right, shifting gears, getting back to some in-season Cougar sports. I did want to talk about Cougar softball, who went 3-2 for the second straight weekend this past weekend to start the season for the math challenge that puts Houston at 6-4 on the year now. The Cougs had that 3-2 weekend by beating the teams that they, you know, kind of quote-unquote should, but Sam missing both opportunities to pick up a top 25 win against Washington for the second straight year.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the kind of negative takeaway, I think, from the past week, that you had two opportunities to get a really nice, really resume-building kind of non-conference win with the Washington Huskies, and your two opportunities kind of bookending your weekend games. And despite, I think, in both games having your moments where either you had the lead or you're at least within striking distance of getting back in the game, you never really were able to close out either try. But I think it's also important that we're talking about teams 6-4 coming in today, 7-4 after tonight's win over HCU, that I think you're still in a better spot than you were 2 weeks into last season, because we're also still at this point talking about a team that hasn't really taken any bad losses in its first 11 games. Obviously, the goal is to win some of those big games, but at least you're not in the position you are last year where it's like, oh man, you already got a loss to a not that great McNeese, not vintage Texas State, You're not in that position this year, which I think is good. But started out with a Friday opener against the Washington Huskies. Matty Boyd made, I think, the somewhat surprising start in the circle. Pitched out of some early trouble. Ended up being certainly the best game of her collegiate career and her Cougar career to date. Retired the first three hitters she faced. Did have to work around a bases loaded jam. The next inning had her only blemishes, unearned runs in the third inning, but threw two scoreless innings to end her day, and ended her day in that fifth inning by stranding a Washington runner that had started out at second with no outs. Cougar hitters also, at least for a time of this game, put the team in decent position. Got the team on the board first with a Bree Cantu dinger in the second inning. Another one of your first-year transfers, Brooke Lorenzo, broke the subsequent tie from the unearned runs that I mentioned earlier with an RBI single. Scored Paige Halsey. Cougars had a 3-2 lead, but unfortunately it all came unraveled late when the normally reliable Kenna Wilkie relieved Boyd, and after the opening batter grounded out, six straight Husky hitters reached base, the tying and ultimately winning runs, I think very painfully, coming off of a bases loaded hit by pitch and bases loaded walk respectively. At Washington tacked on a run in the seventh, and this one finished as a 6-3 Husky victory. We'll say, obviously, once again, we're talking about a game against a high-level opponent where the Cougar pitching didn't match up, but your lineup did miss opportunities in the third, fourth, and fifth inning to add to that run tally, and I think this Washington team is so good, you can't miss opportunities when you have them against a top 25 opponent. And I think, again, still worth distinguishing this from anything like a bad loss, but would have been a really nice chance to get a great resume win to start the weekend. But Cougars did have a nice rebound in the nightcap, took on Morgan State, last year's regular season MEAC champions. Thankfully, a pretty stress-free Cougar win. Was a bit quiet offensively early against the Lady Bears after that no-doubter Tariah Coleman homer in the first. Traded scoreless frames until the fifth. We'll say Taylor Edwards, your starting pitcher, was ruthlessly efficient through a complete game shutout, only faced above the minimum number of MSU hitters in two of her seven innings in the circle. Bats did finally wake up in the fifth inning. Janiya Thomas got things started with an RBI single. No surprise, Tariah Coleman also subsequently contributed an RBI single. Back-to-back sacrifice flies from Katie Rapa and Katie Ray Brown put the Cougars up 5-0, and that's where the nightcap would finish. Cougars had on Saturday a pair of, I would say, probably must-win games. Opened up against Hofstra, probably the weakest opponent in the field. Certainly an opponent that would have fallen in that bad loss category. But thankfully, the Cougars didn't make anyone with a rooting interest in them stress too much. Kenna Wilkie was just as efficient as Edwards had been the previous evening. She tossed a complete game shutout, rarely let the Hofstra hitters threaten. Katie Rippa kicked off the scoring in the first. She had an RBI double. Janiya Thomas scored on that one. Brooke Lorenzo added an RBI single of her own in the second. Bree Cantu had her second dinger in as many days, and the Cougars would need not that much more offense, would win by a final margin of 3-0. You'd get a rematch with Morgan State in the evening, maybe a little bit more competitive than that Friday night game. Morgan State actually took an early lead via a solo homer in the second, but Cougars did a nice job responding the next frame. Janiya Thomas, RBI single. Thomas would later score off of Bree Cantu, fielder's choice. And I thought a little bit of wildness from your sophomore starting pitcher, Hannah Blanco, but Morgan State tied the game, but Blanco really settled down after that. Didn't allow the Bears to score again. The Cougars scored three in their final two innings, took a 5-2 lead, and gave the Cougars a 2-0 Saturday, as well as Blanco's first Division I win. As you mentioned at the top, you had the bookending games against the Washington Huskies. The Cougars got that one more shot, but really kind of out of this one after committing three errors in the second inning. Washington only needed two hits in that second inning to put up a five spot, chased starter Taylor Edwards from the game. We'll give some credit to Kenna Wilkie. She really stabilized things through 4 1/3 innings of scoreless relief, but a five-run hole against this Washington team is a pretty tough hole to climb out of. Huskies tacked on two in the top of the seventh at the Cougars. Cut 5-3 previously on a Tariah Coleman dinger, 7-3 final. Really remarkable, Dustin, quick aside, that we ended up with 10 runs in this finale despite the two teams 10 runs on a combined 7 hits. So the teams were certainly making the most of their hits in this one, and unfortunately, Cougars, not a bad weekend, but didn't get either of your chances against a really, I guess, game-changing non-conference opponent.
And then this coming weekend, for the third straight weekend, Houston will be hosting a home tournament and playing five games, facing both a pair of power conference teams and then a pair of local schools as well. I've actually gotten underway already, Sam, here on Thursday evening.
Yeah, the Cougars won 4-1 over HCU. Still feels weird to say, Dustin, the opening game of the final of the three early season multi-team events. The Cougars are hosting the Houston tournament. Started this one on a good note. Starting pitcher Taylor Edwards got in a little trouble, but stranded a HCU runner on third with one out. That kind of set the tone. The Cougars immediately responded in the bottom half of the inning, putting up a crooked number. Brittany Shaw doubles home to Ryan Coleman. Shaw would advance to third and eventually score due to some wildness from the HCU pitcher. HCU did cut the lead to 2-1, but Cougars pulled away late. Another complete game from Taylor Edwards, who I think has started to really kind of establish herself as, you know, maybe one of your pitchers to keep an eye on outside of Kenneth Wilkie, who I think is still the staff's most high leverage arm. But again, not to beat a dead horse here, but you didn't take a bad loss. And the Cougars have some decent opportunities against some opponents this coming week. And really, I would say one opponent on Friday evening. The Cougars are going to play two games in a row against Illinois, the second coming immediately after on Saturday afternoon at 3 p.m. I wouldn't say the Illini would be a huge, huge non-conference one, but they're 5-4 to date against a pretty decent strength of schedule. They were at last weekend's Big Ten ACC Challenge in Clearwater, went 3-1 against Louisville and Georgia Tech collectively. Saturday night, the Cougars will also face Pitt, who are, to their credit, 6-3 to start the season, but were the worst team in the ACC last year, posted 2-20 conference record, but beat a top 25 Auburn team in the first weekend of this season, so maybe a bit better Panther team. And the Cougars will close on Sunday against Sam Houston State. The Bearcats are currently 5-6 and have common opponent losses to UVA, Delaware, and South Dakota State. They went 2-3 last week in the Tracy Beard College Classic. Kind of put that one in the category of a game you should probably win. And I might say, I don't think this will be a successful weekend if you can't at least get 2-3 against Pitt and Illinois. I think if this team is what we think it is or is what it should be with this roster, I think we should at least take 2-3 from that collective trio of games against the Illini and Panthers.
All right, and then sticking with the bat and ball sports, Cougar baseball opened the season this past weekend by hosting Cal for a three-game series. They then traveled to UTSA for a midweek contest, and we knew that these were going to be four crucial games for the Cougs because they represented half of the eight non-conference games that Houston has on the schedule against teams that were in the top 100 of the RPI last year. And unfortunately, Houston went just 1-3 in those four contests to open the season. Began the year losing the first two games to Cal, salvaged the win on Sunday, but then took a trip down I-10 and got run ruled by the Roadrunners. So not the best start to the season for the Cougs. Opening night, definitely a bummer. The Cougs managed just three hits, did not score a run. Cal put up three runs apiece in the third and fourth innings, added one more in the seventh for a 7-0 victory over Houston. And, you know, the Cougs announced Friday night starter as Cade Satelli, UT Arlington transfer, someone very much in the developmental category more than the proven commodity category. And for three innings, he looked really strong, had a very clean first trip through the lineup, but the second time through had a lot more trouble, couldn't get outs. So, you know, four innings, three runs certainly isn't the dream what you want to get from your Friday guy. But I think there were some things to build on there at the very least. And, you know, I guess kind of on some level, it doesn't really matter what your starter does when you score zero runs. Saturday was a little bit more compelling, which was nice for me because I made it out for that game. Sat with friend of the pod, Crawford, for that game. Went to the sixth scoreless behind a strong start from Kyle Calametto for Houston, while Cal kind of did the bullpen game deal. It also stayed scoreless that long because Drew Bianco made a home run saving catch in center field. Certainly wanted to go on the season highlight reel. The Golden Bears finally struck first, top of the sixth. Brandon Use immediately answers with a solo home run to tie it up in the bottom of the sixth. Cal retakes the lead on a two-run double in the seventh. Ian McMillan answers with a two-run double in the eighth to tie it back up again. But unfortunately, the Golden Bears scratched out a couple more runs in the ninth. Houston was not able to answer, dropping a 5-3 final to fall to 0-2. On the year, Saturday, it was not the game that I went to. It very much seems like it was the game to go to if you were to pick a game to go to this past weekend. Very fun one. Might be the one game from the season where we see the most like lead changes. Cal scored two runs right away in the first. Houston ties it up with two in the second. Cal goes up 3-2. Houston goes up 4-3. Cal goes up 5-4. Houston goes up 6-5. Cal ties it up at 6 in the top of the 8th. And then Zach Arnold and Alex Lopez drive in runs to make it an 8-6 Cougar lead. In the bottom of the 8th, Jose Torrealba finishes off, gets the last four outs to close this one out and get Houston their first victory of the year. Brandon Brickell, two-run double and an RBI double from the nine hole, went 3 for 3 in this one. Eight different guys for Houston scored and or drove in a run in this one. So just really strong, good overall team hitting performance on Sunday from Houston. Really good, you know, persistence to stick with it in a game that had that many twists and turns and lead changes. And good to see the Cougs kind of pick up a big character victory and not pick up and not allow Cal to get away with the sweep. You know, being one game below 500 in a three-game series looks an awful lot better than going 0-3 in a three-game home series. So salvaging some respectability from the opening weekend for sure. Unfortunately, on Wednesday, like I mentioned, went to San Antonio and the bats came out cold again, not scoring until the seventh inning. By then, UTSA had already scratched out a run in the first, plated two more in the third, two more in the fifth, and then had a breakout sixth inning to make it an 11-0 lead. And then Houston manufactured a couple runs in the top of the seventh to finally get on the board, but UTSA scored again in the bottom half of the inning to make it a 12-2 score, which activated the run rule and ended the game early. Houston actually used 11 different pitchers in a game that did not even go the full nine innings, which is a little bit wild. Unfortunately, speaking of wild, those 11 guys combined to issue nine walks, hit two batters, and throw five wild pitches. So as a single game data point in the ongoing can Kyle Bunn mold these hard throwers into actual pitchers storyline, this was a bad data point. And you know, then for the lineup, you know, after that really encouraging effort on Sunday, another quiet game, and that's now 3 out of 4 games in which Houston has not scored a run until at least the sixth inning, if not if scoring any runs at all. So I know that the bats often start the season behind the arms quite often, but you know, Houston's lineup definitely supposed to be the team's strong suit. Would behoove the Cougs to find a way to score runs earlier in the ball game. In addition to obviously needing to do a little bit better in the pitching aspect for sure. So, you know, try not to overreact to four games, but it's hard not to be a little bit reminded of last year's team where Houston had, again, a non-conference schedule that didn't have a lot of, you know, very interesting or kind of high-value games on it. And they opened the season with one of the good weekends, the tournament they played out in Arizona, and went 0-3 in those games. And obviously that kind of was a little bit of an indicator of, you know, the season. Obviously, that Houston ended up winning a lot of games, won a lot of their kind of quote-unquote should-win games, and had a respectable season, but, you know, kind of lost out on that first big chance to make an impression and didn't get too many more and ended the season, you know, comfortably outside of the NCAA tournament field. So, again, like I said, certainly not going to make those, you know, gloom and doom predictions for this year based on four games, but given the small number of opportunities that you have to pick up potentially quality wins, going 1-3 against Cal and UTSA, Sam, definitely not what I think anybody associated with the program or, you know, even from the fan perspective wanted to see.
No, and that's the major peril of not scheduling the hardest non-conference, is that you can't look back this weekend and be like, okay, well, it was a bad four-game run, but we'll have a number of other good resume opportunities both in the non-conference and conference schedule. You did a good chunk. I mean, it was half of the top 100 RPI non-conference opponents this past four games, right?
Yeah, 4 out of 8.
And you lost 3 of 4. Two of the four were very non-competitive, and one of the other losses, you looked a bit worse than I think you would hope to look offensively. I mean, I think these hitters can be a lot better than they've shown, but when you have so few opportunities against quality opponents, it's almost like, well, I hope they do well in these other games, but kind of the wins from here, I'm not going to say it's empty calories, but maybe one step above that, you're not getting as much meaningful out of that. And I think only managing 3 runs in that first 18 innings of the first weekend series, it's kind of concerning, and you weren't really unlucky to be shut out in the opener. Glad, obviously, that the bats woke back up facing the end of Cal's rotation on Sunday, and glad we kind of saw something a lot more like the offense we expected in the preseason. But I mean, I know volatile stuff happens in midweek games, but it's not overdoing the expectations to hope that this game against UTSA would have been a bit more competitive than getting run ruled. And again, it's 4 games of sample size, but 28 walks in 33 innings is terrifying, Dustin. And I know it's 2 of the better non-conference opponents you're going to face, but if we're going to be a almost a walk an inning on average team against the better teams in the schedule, then and I hope this is the coldest of many cold takes I've spoken in this microphone, but if this is what we can expect, or at least something closer for the duration of the season, then I don't think we have a prayer of being a postseason team. Again, very early, that could change. I certainly hope it changes, but I don't think you leave these first four games feeling any better about pitching staff where we had a lot of unknowns. And I think certainly you're going to see a better offense, but you're running out of opportunities to do it against quality competition. And you've given yourself kind of this, I guess, really narrow margin of error. But Dustin, Cougars will get three chances down in Corpus this weekend to kind of right the ship, will they not?
That's correct. They'll be at beautiful Whataburger Field this weekend, facing Utah on Friday afternoon, A&M Corpus on Saturday evening, and Incarnate Word on Sunday morning. Trio of teams that are, you know, I think in the, you know, not good but not awful category. The Utes were right around 500 last year, just outside the top 100 of the RPI. Opened this season losing 3 out of 4 to the University of San Francisco, who is not an especially strong team. Islanders of A&M Corpus also right around 500 last year, RPI of 189. They won 2 out of 3 against UT Arlington at home to open the season, then got clobbered by UT Austin in the midweek. Incarnate Word also in the 180s of the RPI last year. They opened the season losing 2 out of 3 to Southern Illinois University Edwardsville at home, and then fell to Tarleton State in the midweek also at home. So a 1-3 start for the Cardinals, who you may remember are led by former U of H assistant Ryan Schatzberger. You may also remember that Houston beat them 2 out of 3 in a weekend series last year. And then the Cougs will also keep it going by facing, by hosting Texas Southern on Tuesday. TSU, as you might imagine, a team well outside of the top 200 of the RPI on a regular basis. So, you know, four teams that are, none of them are really that good. You know, I think especially Utah is a team that might not be a pushover, but these are four teams that are pretty comfortably worse than Cal and UTSA. So, you know, this is the part of the schedule where, kind of like you mentioned, you need to start winning games, you know, not because that there's a lot of big opportunities to pick up marquee wins, but you just can't afford some of these losses. So, you know, like I said, trying to remain reasonably optimistic after just four games into the season, but I think the Cougs really need to win at least three of their next four to get back to 500.
Dustin, you know what's going to make you feel a bit more optimistic?
What's that?
Talking about Cougar Indoor Track and Field doing its last ever American Conference Championships over at the Birmingham Crossplex here this coming weekend.
Yeah, the Cougs looking forward to that. They did get snuck one last regular season indoor meet in. It was not even on the schedule until like the last second, at least not the one posted online, but a handful of Cougs competed at the Arkansas qualifier in Fayetteville. The headliner was Kellyanne Beckford, who running the 800 meters for Houston for the third straight meet, broke the school record in the 800, this time shaved over 2 full seconds off of her best time, finishing 2:02.59. That is good for the 9th best time in the country this year, putting her very much in contention to qualify for NCAA championships. Sydney Townsend, another big performance. The North Carolina A&T transfer actually made her Cougar debut in the 400 meters, waited until the last meet of the indoor regular season to make her Cougar debut, but had a debut to remember, finishing with a time of 53.34. That is the best mark anybody in the American Athletic Conference has put down so far this season, so certainly makes her one to keep an eye on as we head to AAC championships, which are just about to get underway as we're recording this on late Thursday evening. Now they do take place Friday and Saturday in Birmingham. The Cougar men will be looking for their 8th straight AAC indoor title. Would also be nice to see Houston lifting the conference hardware after the surprising and disappointing second place finish at outdoors last year. The women's team had won 2 straight indoor titles coming into last season, but had a rough showing at indoors. So hopefully they can kind of get their mojo back. However, notably, UCF looks like the clear-cut class of the conference all, you know, indoor and outdoor season last year on the women's side. And really looking at a number of individuals that have put up, you know, like top 50 times this year, UCF looking well ahead of the Cougs again this year. So obviously hope I'm wrong, but don't see the Cougs maybe seriously challenging the Knights on the women's side. But nonetheless, a lot of individual performances that will be up in the air, and a lot of athletes, you know, because only really a handful of Cougs, a couple of Cougs at this point, have those top 16 times that you need to qualify for nationals. So big conference meet coming up in terms of overall team performances, and then seeing, you know, how many Cougs and how many events can put up their absolute best times of the year and hopefully get themselves qualified for nationals.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add just on the women's side, I think it's less about, because like you said, UCF is rightfully a big favorite. I think it's just about performing better than you did last year and getting a few more individuals potentially in position to compete in the indoor championships here coming up.
All right, next up, Cougar men's golf. And Sam, I have seen that the Cougar men's golf team has opened the spring season with a pair of second place finishes. How good should we be feeling about that?
I think reasonably good. I'm going to talk about the most recent one here primarily, but I would say everything I say is with the context that I don't know if the field, well, I shouldn't say, I don't know if you could draw the same conclusions about the fields of teams the Cougars went against in their events versus what the women did. I think it was a lot more challenging slate of opponents that you're going to talk about with the Cougar women, but we'll say, I think there's positive things to take away from finishing second at the Bayou City Collegiate Classic like the Cougars did this past week. Santiago de la Fuente, who I think probably going into the spring season, the individual you and I were most excited about, finishing tied for second among all competitors, his first U of H event for the spring, 8 under par. Rice grad transfer Campbell Gibson, a new guy, his first event, wanted to mention him, super senior, finished tied for fourth, was just one stroke back of De La Fuente at 7 under par. And Austin Riley, somebody who's been one of those, hey, he's had some big individual moments in his career, but nothing really consistent over a full season, I think from fall to present, has played his most consistently excellent golf, finished in the top 10, was the Cougs' third lowest score, finishing at 5 under par, just inside the individual top 10. Like I said, it wasn't a hugely stacked event. The only golf stat top 50 team in the Bayou City Collegiate Classic field was Southern Miss, though. I thought the Cougars did put a nice amount of distance between themselves and Lamar and Oral Roberts, who were both tied for third, 7 strokes back. So I'll be curious. You know, does Santiago de la Fuente continue this excellent season he's had so far? How much is this new arrival Gibson going to feature in the future tournament fives that Jonathan Dismuke sends out for the rest of the season? And obviously what we see from Santiago de la Fuente, because I think what we've seen from de la Fuente is a guy with a higher ceiling than, I'm not trying to set the expectations too high or Dustin, but I would say he's the closest thing to Michael Paris we've had as a golfer in this program since Michael Paris 5 or 6 years ago. And that's not praise I give to anyone lightly.
All right. And then on the women's side, the Cougs opened the spring season at the San Diego State Classic. They were halfway through it during our last episode. They did what I mentioned. They ended up finishing fourth out of 12 teams. Houston was one of four top 50 ranked teams in the 12 team field, and those teams finished 1 through 4, with Houston finishing fourth. So maybe a bit of a missed opportunity to finish ahead of a good team, but at least the Cougs, kind of like you mentioned with the men, finished ahead of all the not so good teams, and certainly was a tough environment to play in. The conditions were pretty lousy by all reports, despite the fact I find that hard to believe given that it happened in San Diego. But yeah, apparently even in San Diego they do have bad weather and poor golfing conditions on occasion. I know, hard to believe. And it's, I think that is indicative of the, indicated by the fact that the individual champion in this one finished at even par. Houston's top performer was senior Annie Kim, who finished in a tie for 11th at 12 over. A couple of Cougar freshmen doing well like usual, and then Wofford transfer Becca Earl making her Cougar debut, finished tied for 22nd. So Cougs will be back in action on Monday when they will be competing at the Icon Invitational, just here, right up at the Golf Club of Houston up in Humble. And then finally, did want to mention Cougar Tennis, who, Sam, went on the road and picked up a pair of wins this past week to push their winning streak to 6 matches.
They sure did, making the trip a few hours east on I-10 to the heart of Cajun country in Lafayette, where they took on Nichols and Ooala, both of which ended up being fairly comfortable. Cougar wins. Two opponents that U of H should certainly expect to be, but you can pick very few nits from how the Cougars got from point A to point B on both of these team wins. First was Nichols on Saturday. The Cougars won 6-1. A little drama at the beginning. The doubles pairing of Sonia Kovalenko and Azul Pedamonte from the Cougars did comfortably win their match 6-0, but the pairing of Elena Tracheva and Sophie Scouten took their match by a dramatic 7-6 final, left an unfinished and tied doubles match where Cougars Laura Sassani and Blanca Cortillo Pereno, thankfully went unfinished with the Cougars taking that doubles point. We'll give the Colonels, or I guess the Lady Colonels, credit. The singles matches were largely quite competitive. Only Maria Jemishkevich and Sonia Kovalenko won their matches in straight sets. Freshman Gabriela Cortez had her tiebreaker go all the way to 12-10 before she pulled out the win over Nichols's Laura Lopez. Ended up being the final match of the day as the Cougars, as I said, secured that 6-1 win, and we're back in action on Sunday against the host Raging Cajuns. On the double side of things, once again, Pettamonte and Kovalenko won their doubles match comfortably, followed by a 6-4 win from Slasane and Cortilla Pereno, leaving one match unfinished in singles matches. I would say we're a lot more convincing than the Saturday match against Nichols. Jemishkevich once again won her singles match in straight sets over her opponent. Also, Slasane, Scouten, and Cortez had fairly comfortable straight set wins, and I'm sure in part because of this being a travel day, the match was called done after Cortez's match win, specifically with the Cougars having clinched a team win. So, all in all, expected wins, but I think fairly comprehensive on both days, and we certainly don't turn our nose up at the podcast here at teams taking care of business, and the Cougars will be back in action in the friendly confines of the Barbara Winston Tennis Center on Saturday morning at 11 a.m. Against the Yulee Monroe Warhawks. Last match before the Cougars play a couple of conference opponents at the beginning of March.
All right, that's where we're going to go ahead and end this jam-packed and lengthy episode. On our way out, going to give a huge, huge, just massive, frankly, Scott Holman podcast thank you to our Patreon supporters. We continue to show our appreciation by, I guess, every episode but this one, doing a podcast.
Yeah, it's 100 minutes, guys. Didn't have the time this week. Sorry.
But we'll start getting those back in rotation.
That's my verbal promise to you, those of you who listen 100 minutes in.
So yeah, we'll get those questions in, and we'll continue to put out the premium content as a thank you for our Patreon supporters as well. So if you are interested in supporting Sam and I and getting that bonus content, go to patreon.com/shpodcast where you can sign up for $5 a month and access that premium content. We also would love hearing from you, the listener. You can email us shpodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us at @shpodcast. That's it for us. If you made it all 100 minutes into this one, congratulations. You're an absolute rock star. And as always,
go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Vamos los Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
We ain't invited to the party. We had to kick the door in. No cap. No cap. No cap.